Hello and welcome to the final two posts of A Scare a Day. So this is day 30 and day 31. Happy Halloween, everybody! Both of these stories can be found online and the links are in my original posts. They're also on the Romancing the Gothic site for the A Scare a Day challenge list 2025. So day 30, which was yesterday, Bleeding Hearts by Susan Palumbo. This one's not that scary. It's not meant to be scary. I think it's just like a very witchy vibes kind of one. I love Susan Palumbo's work. I've interviewed her on this podcast, in fact, for her release of Skin Thief, which was her collection of short stories. I really love this short story. It was one I haven't read before. It's very appropriate for spooky season and it's quite romantic. It's got a little bit of a sapphic romance subplot going on. And I love the way it's one of those stories where she mixes in so many layers and weaves very human dramas into so few words in such a short, tight space. I love that about Susan's work. I really like the idea of grief diffusing into something that grows. So, like the garden of grief, that's beautiful imagery, and a garden of other people's pain, where you put blood into the soil and tears, and then a plant will grow and that will diffuse the pain that you're feeling and you'll feel better. I loved the ex-girlfriend's misery, screw you, Rebecca. And I love how things develop between Ashley and Claire and that relationship sort of over the garden wall and that kind of lovely persistence that Claire has. I also love that with the garden, you can't cure the heartbreak, but you can diffuse it. And I love that then you can do whatever you want to that plant. So you can just let it grow, you can chop it down, you can take it, repot it, and put it somewhere else because it's your grief to do with what you want, it's your pain to do with what you want. And I think that's also quite evocative and yeah, I really enjoyed that imagery. I've got a link to the interview I did with Susan Palumbo in my main post, along with the transcript as well. So you can listen to that here or on your platform of choice, and you can read the transcript either here or you can read it on my website. This one reminded me of the folklore around plants springing from people's graves and tales where these trees or bushes then become home to the spirits of the dead in the form of birds, sometimes who sing about their murder and the abuse they suffered in life, like the Germanic folktale The Juniper Tree comes to mind here. So I thought about this as an ending to my necromancy story, which has three parts so far, written for A Scare a Day. So this is the final part of my necromancy quartet of stories, the Yew Tree, and you can catch up with the other three parts on the podcast and linked on my Ko-fi master list. The Yew Tree. Flaubert and Gauguin stood in deep mutual sorrow, without words. What could they say? The dead numbered in the hundreds. The destruction was unimaginable. Something that could only be seen, and even then could not be fully understood. Each person is a cosmos, a world, a thousand ripples in a lake of dark stillness. How can their loss be calculated? How can their absence be weighed? And hundreds at once, the collective horror upon the individual horror, the cumulative as well as the singular grief, the tragedy building like an unfathomable monster appearing from the primordial abyss. What could they say? Isabeau lay down in the grave they had dug for her. She had told them where to dig, of course, and all was done to her specifications. Even now, neither of the two friends could have possibly done this themselves. There was no question of breaking their bond with Isabeau. She was their flesh, their very lives, their greatest love. Isabeau had made the choice herself, and they had no choice, as ever, but to fall into line. Now she lay down in her chosen resting place, hands folded over her bosom, and lay looking upwards. "Start with the topsoil," she said. They sprinkled the layers of soil in reverse, each layer with the life bled from it, spoiled and sown through with salt, so that from it nothing could grow. Isabeau did not cry out as it covered her beautiful face, but Faubert thought he saw it begin to crumble away into the soil it had once been, the soil used to resurrect her bones. As the grave filled, and Isabeau's remains fell back through time, buried once more under the weight of it, a sapling began to sprout from the place the headstone would have been laid. Faubert felt Isabeau's hold on him lift with the rising of that impossible tree. Gaudin must have felt it too, for he began to work with renewed vigour, backfilling the grave with all the power he could muster after the last layer of soil was sprinkled down, covering her gradual disintegration. The sapling kept pace with the backfill, pushing upwards as the hollow in the earth levelled out once more. When they stood back, it was a fully grown yew tree, spreading a sombre canopy of darkness above them. Gaudin looked at Faubert, but he said nothing. Faubert could not muster anything other than a long, slow blink of exhaustion. He had buried his words, his thoughts, his very self with Isabeau. It would take a long time for them to come back to him, with the red berries of autumn, with the slow ripening of harvest. When the seasons rolled on, his self would return again. All things healed, changed, found their way, given time. For now there was no Faubert, no Gaudin, without the woman lost to the soil. Nothing except the yew tree growing from the salted earth. And that was the necromancy story conclusion. So that was kind of following on from the World War I themes that I was thinking about, and that was the themes of a few of the poems that we had earlier in the month. Well, day 31, which is today, today's story, the final story in the challenge, is The Path She Sings by Vanessa Fogg. I love this one. This came out this year. It's really creepy, very, very moving. It reminded me a bit of Karen Warren's Eleanor Atkins is Dead and Her House is Boarded Up, which we had for day 25. It's very heartrending. So the premise here is that there is a fog that tries to take living people, that it fills your house, you lie down, you have to pretend to be dead, and the fog will leave you alone. But it gets the wife of the main character, who then becomes this perambulating corpse who says a lot of nonsense words and wanders around the house or just lies down still for periods of time. And just this idea of sharing a house with a dead person that won't lie down forever, or just, you know, and having to make a choice about what you do, people treating you like a widow and leaving you food, but then saying, you know, you should really get this over with, you need to decapitate the corpse, you need to put it in the ground, and just not being able to do that, and then just wanting to follow your spouse into the mist, into the strange changing fog, and following the path that the corpse sings for you to follow, and the strange rhymes and words that your dead spouse is saying. And I thought that was really, really beautiful, very, very sad. And there's just something gorgeous about the loss and emptiness, the way that that's written, and stepping into another state of being you cannot comprehend from living outside it, which I think is what this is really about. As much as it seems to be about death and grief and loss, it's also about a fundamental misunderstanding or a fear of what you cannot explain or what you don't understand from living outside of a state of being that somebody else is occupying. And the only way you can truly understand their perspective and what they are trying to tell you, what they are trying to communicate to you, is by immersing yourself in that state and in that perspective. And it's all depicted really movingly within such a short space, because it is just a short story, and I think it's really worth having a read of. I've got so many authors now that I want to read more from. I'm adding Vanessa Fogg to that list for sure. Well, today is also the release day for Occupying Bodies, which is a body horror anthology that my Sad Revenant story is in. This is from an Australian independent press, Black Hare Press. Hare as in the animal. The premise here is a revenant whose last imprinted memory is of the long-distance partner they never got to meet in real life after starting a relationship online. And the revenant is now dragging themselves along train tracks in a desert on their way to where their partner used to live and where they hope that their partner still lives. That's my story. It's called Along the Xylophone Road. The actual anthology itself is called Occupying Bodies. It's compiled by Bernardo Villela and edited by Dean Shawker. The blurb reads as follows. You can escape your past, your fears, even your mind, but never the body you occupy. The body is the first prison, the final battlefield, and the one thing we can never abandon. Yet what happens when the flesh betrays us, when consciousness claws against its cage, when skin, bone, and blood twist into something unrecognizable? Occupying Bodies is a visceral anthology of body horror that explores the dread of living inside fragile, treacherous vessels. Within these pages, nightmares take the form of grotesque mutations, psychological unravelings, everyday afflictions magnified into terrors, and Cronenbergian transformations that defy imagination. Each story forces us to confront the inevitability of flesh, the aches, the ruptures, the decay, and asks whether escape is salvation or damnation. Curated by Bernardo Villela, this collection gathers diverse voices united by one chilling truth. No monster is more intimate, more inescapable than the body you inhabit. So I can give you just a little quote from my story, which is called Along the Xylophone Road. This is from the middle of the story. It's very short, it's not even 2,000 words, so I can't really quote very much of it, and I get the rights back in about 12 months, and then I might do something else with it or post it in its entirety. But I would encourage you to buy the anthology and to read the other stories in it as well. So here's a little quote from Along the Xylophone Road. There is something inside my brain. It keeps me company as I move forwards under the blanket of heat and light pressing down on my broken back. It doesn't hurt. I can feel it moving inside my skull, tickling parts of me into spasm and sparking my emotions into life, like light hammers tapping on taut strings. I wonder if that is why the morning looks different today. There is something inside my throat. I'm not sure if I want it there, and it stops me forming sounds the way I want to. I could barely say anything the first time we called, do you remember? We had gone beyond small talk, and only the abyss was left, and I was afraid of the depths you wanted to plumb. I choked up words that I hadn't told another soul, the way I choked up clots when it all went wrong. Now I'm afraid I have no more words for you, but you have the ones I wrote down and the song I wrote for you. And I am still choking, but I hope you'll forgive me. I didn't mean to leave it so long to see you, but I am coming now. I am coming. So there we go, that's a little quote for you from Along the Xylophone Road. And that brings us to the end of A Scare a Day. But what were my top five stories and or poems from this month's list? Well, that's exceptionally hard. Very, very hard to work out. I think I've whittled it down to my top five. I don't know if it's going to be the five that you expect it to be. I have included the poems and short stories together, so that's made it even harder. So my top five, and you'll find the links to these directly in the episode notes actually as well, but you can also go to my website cmrosens.com and my Ko-fi and find the posts for yourselves there, where all the links and everything else are as well. But actually, I'm starting off with number one. Da, da, da. Got to be October 27th, Helen Stubbs, Uncontainable, published in 2016. I actually really loved this. I loved the world building. I think this is the most enjoyable one for me. My criteria here was, what am I going to reread? This is the one. Possibly a joint first. Is that cheating? Is Nibbedita sends 10 excerpts from an annotated bibliography on the cannibal woman of Ratnabar Island, which was October 28th, published 2019. I loved this one too. I think it's so multi-layered. I think this is definitely a joint first place. So that's made it even harder for me to work out what other stories and poems are in my top five. However, I think the next one I'm going to go with is Conrad Aiken's The Vampire, the poem published in 1916. I think genuinely this is one of my favourite World War I poems. I think it's one of my favourite poems in general. I loved the imagery of that. I really loved the feelings that it gave me, the chill it left me with. Overall, yeah, 10 out of 10, no notes. Number four, this was quite hard. This was a toss-up between The Canal by Everil Worrell, which was published in 1927, and Hugh Walpole's The Tarn, published in 1936. One of the things that I really love about A Scare a Day is that if you follow the hashtag, you can see everybody else's interpretations and reactions to the stories. And some of these really, like, maybe think about them in completely different ways. I particularly loved Julia O'Connell's interpretations this year. Thanks, Julia, for posting. And I say that because some of Julia's interpretations of The Tarn made me think about it differently and have like a different appreciation of it. But that said, I think for me, it's gotta be The Canal, which was October 18th. So I'm gonna go with The Canal, final answer. And that just leaves our final story, number five. Gonna go with an older one. It's gonna be October the 8th, Rhoda Broughton, The Truth, The Whole Truth, and Nothing But the Truth, 1868. Final answer, that's my number five. This was so hard to whittle down, but okay, those are the five that really stood out for me. Honourable mentions go to Robert Herrick, The Hag, 1648 poem, really enjoyed that. The Elopement, Johann Carl August Musos, 1801, really enjoyed that. I did like the Dinah Mulock one. I did like the Madeleine Wynne one, which is The Little Room, 1907. I like the Agatha Christie one, I like the Clive Barker one, I like the Flann O'Brien one. Sweet Subtleties by Lisa Hannett was amazing, and that should have been in my top five. But I think it didn't make it because it also, I won't be reading that again, like ever. And that is a compliment to Lisa L. Hannett. That was phenomenal, but I'm not going to put it in my top five. It's in a league of its own. I think everyone should read that. It was published in 2012. It's free to read online. And just because it's not in my personal top five does not mean that I didn't enjoy it. I mean, I didn't enjoy it, but like, I didn't enjoy it in such a way that it was so visceral. I genuinely think that that one is like, there's my top five and then there's Sweet Subtleties. Make of that what you will. Susan Palumbo, I love Susan's work, and I love Vanessa Fogg, the last one today. I also loved Karen Warren, which I've talked about a lot as well. Eleanor Atkins is dead and her house is boarded up. Again, that was another one that I read first and was like, oh, okay, yeah, I've got some thoughts on that. And then I read other people's thoughts on that story. And again, I think it was Julia O'Connell's interpretation of it, and like, can evil be needy? And you know, like that sort of thing, like is she an unreliable perspective and that kind of thing. And that really opened that story up for me a little bit more. Yeah, there's just, I liked all of them. I found something to really like about all of them, but that was my top five. And then a league of its own honourable mention for Sweet Subtleties as like your bonus star kind of one. Yeah, that's, I'm going to have to go with those. Thank you so much to Dr. Sam Hurst of RomancingTheGothic.com for this challenge. They have handpicked all of the stories. They do this every year. You can catch up on all of the previous years. It must be getting much harder and harder to pick ones that everybody can read that are public domain or have links or, you know, and Yeah, just really appreciate the amount of effort and work that goes into a scare a day every single year. Thank you so much. It is honestly a joy to participate in. But a scare a day was not the only challenge I have been doing. Oh no, I've also been doing the 100 horror movies in 92 days challenge, in which you have to watch as many new to you horror films as you can between the 1st of August and the 31st of October. I'm very pleased to say that I have completed this challenge too. A big thank you to Sarah Stubbs, who formed this challenge on Letterboxd and has been running it for several years now and has a Discord with watch-alongs and group watches and things like that. Really appreciate all of the effort that Sarah puts into the different movie challenges as well. By the way, you can find Sam Hurst on social media at RomGothSam, and you can find Sarah Stubbs at SpookySarahSays. So I'm just going to give you a quick rundown of my top picks from my 100 horror films in 92 days list. I really couldn't narrow this down at first. I ended up with a long list of about 30 odd different films. I think actually 41 different films, because I just couldn't narrow it down. In the end, I just went with the criteria of what was most interesting to me. Which films am I going to be thinking about for a really long time? What had the combination of really cool visuals that I thought were like really cool? And what also made me think about things? So that could be because they were very multi-layered films, but it could also just be a couple of images or like a single concept or something like that, but something that stuck in my mind and that I was thinking about a long time after, because I started watching these in August. It's October now, my memory is shocking. So if it's in my head still after all this time, I think it deserves to be in my top 10. I did enjoy so many off this list, and I couldn't put them in any kind of meaningful ranked order. So instead of trying to do that, because for me, when I am watching films, I tend to do that based on how I feel, I tend to do that based on what I need at the time, and so my preferences will change. That is also true for stories. So again, if I were to read all of the A Scare a Day stories and poems again when I was in a different mood, or just doing it again for fun, I might actually change what my top five would be. But that is my top five for the moment. So for my top 10 films, I decided not to try and rank them. I decided what I would do was put them in A to Z order by director's surname from the most recent to come out. So just by year, not by month, to the oldest film to come out. I ended up with quite an interesting list. So A to Z by director's surname, 2025 down to 2021. The top one is The Ugly Stepsister, directed by Emily Christine Blichfeldt. This is a Norwegian film. I watched it in Norwegian, the original Norwegian, without dubbing. And I don't know if I enjoyed it in that kind of way. I mean, I don't know, there's just a lot of really visceral images that will stay with me for a really long time, and I very much liked what it was trying to say about beauty standards, about the way that women do not help one another out where it comes to beauty standards a lot of the time. I thought that was actually quite nuanced and honest, and the way that older women and younger women interact where it comes to beauty, where it comes to passing on torches of standards that are nothing to do with them and are all to do with how attractive you are to men, but also how attractive other women think you are, and those really complex and quite judgmental interactions you can have between old women, younger women, and younger women with one another, and that competitive nature that exists in certain spaces, and dressing up not just to attract specific men's attention, but also so that you can have the approval of women you look up to. And I thought all of that was just really interesting in the way that they depicted it. It's one of those that feels like it was based on a book, but I actually don't think it was because the director actually wrote it. That's what I've got on Letterboxd anyway, because I had a little look to see if it was, is this one of those things where I could follow up with something else? And no, and I was like, oh, okay. And that makes sense actually, because it doesn't feel like an adaptation, it does feel like a complete film. So I was just curious. But yeah, oh my God. I definitely agree with Sarah Stubbs's review where she says, this is gastro horror. And it absolutely is gastro horror because a lot of it is based on weight as part of that. So you've got that fat phobic, impossible beauty standard of slimness and thinness and instant thinness, where, if you don't have the right body type, that's okay because you can starve yourself by swallowing a tapeworm on purpose and giving yourself horrible parasite infested bowels. Like, what the fuck? Yeah. Oh my God, I will be thinking about that scene for the rest of my natural life. Anyway, yeah, that was it. That was a really good one for me. The next one, 2025, directed by Ryan Coogler, was Sinners, of course. I actually saw this when it was streaming on the UK streaming services, and it was $1.99 temporarily on Prime, so I snapped that up. I think I definitely like this more than Ugly Stepsister in terms of how much I enjoyed it. But I don't know, because it's saying like such completely different things. They are two completely different films. And this is why I can't rank them, In terms of enjoyability or watchability, definitely Sinners. There were bits of that that just made me laugh. There were bits that made me cry, and bits that were just really obviously multi-layered. It felt very much like a cultural moment, not just a film. And I think that that has been reflected in a lot of the discourse around the film, a lot of the reactions around the film, and I can definitely see why. So yes, so Sinners is up there for me. The next one, 2024, so you're going back in time. This one, The Mugai by John Bell, directed by John Bell. So this is quite a heavy-handed script in parts, and it's talking about postpartum depression, partly. It's also talking about the lost generation, about mother-daughter relationships and reconciliations, that part of Australian history. It's talking about quite a lot of stuff. I'm not sure that it would be a film that I would re-watch in a hurry. I really don't like bad things happening to babies, and there is an awful lot of child endangerment and, yeah, like actual harm that comes to the baby at a couple of points. And I was just like, oh my God. And so it was quite a visceral watch for me, this one. But I think, I don't know, there was just bits of it that just really got to me, and bits that made me think more about different things, and again, some images that will just stay with me for a really long time. So that's why I think that's up there for me. I do think it's quite a good film. And so, yeah, it's in my personal top 10 from my list. The next one is Rita, 2024. Again, this one directed by Jairo Bustamante. This is a Guatemalan film. I would argue it's more magical realism than it is horror, but it's classed on Letterboxd as horror, drama, fantasy. So I think, yeah, it counts. I also watched La Llorona by the same director, and I loved that one as well. But for me, I don't know, there's just something about Rita that I just couldn't stop thinking about. It's just so sad, and it's really powerful, for me anyway. And again, I really don't like things, bad things happening to children. So I picked a really strange run of films where that exact thing is one of the main themes. But it's about state corruption, and it reminded me a little bit of Tigers Are Not Afraid, the Mexican film, the same way the sort of magical realism was incorporated. So Rita, for me, I think, is up there. My next one is In My Mother's Skin, which came out in 2023, directed by Kenneth Dagatan. This is a Filipino film. It's set in World War II. It's going to stay with me forever. I really like this one. It's got so many different parallels between the young girl's confusion around who to trust and the flesh-eating fairy who's offering her all of this magical stuff, and the way that I think the parallels are being drawn here between the Japanese and the Americans invading the Philippines. And so you've got like a lot of stuff in the adult world going on that parallels the, again, I guess like magical realism aspect of what's going on in the child's world, where she has real problems, like she doesn't have enough food, her mother is dying, her father is absent, and there's so many, you know, so many adult problems that she cannot navigate. And then she finds this fairy in the woods that tells her all of these things could go away if she does X, Y, Z, or if she gives her mother this fruit to eat, and, you know, bad things happen as a result. And she then has to navigate that and then decide what she's going to do going forwards. And, you know, she's putting her brother in danger. She's putting her mother in danger. She's putting herself in danger. You know, like it's all of these kind of decisions that a child shouldn't have to make, but has to because of the circumstances. So this is another war film. It's definitely up there. I think if I was ranking them, this would be very, very high. Yeah, so In My Mother's Skin. The next one I also really, really loved. It was It Lives Inside, 2023, directed by Bishal Dutta. And this is an American, US-made film. This is about a Indian-American family who live in the US. And there is a demon or entity that's travelled with one of the families in their community over from India and is now affecting some of the high school students. So it's kind of like a young adult one, but it's also about identities and about communities and second generation or first generation experiences. So yeah, I think this is quite a good one. I've put it on my emigration horror list, which is, you know, people going from their own country to another country and then finding horror where they end up. So I think that qualifies as going on that list as well. I really quite like this one. I liked what it was trying to say, I think. It reminded me of Omar, which was 2022, directed by Iris K. Shim, which is a similar premise, but a Korean family and sort of a mother-daughter. And the daughter doesn't speak Korean, and the mother has a lot of complicated feelings about her own mother and the abuse that her own mother put her through. And then her mother's ghost kind of haunts the family because of the mum's refusal to do certain traditions and that kind of thing. So yeah, it's about that balance. It Lives Inside also feels like is, you know, trying to be one thing, trying to be another thing, that kind of immigrant dilemma, the paradox, the different identities and different ways that those identities can pull you in different directions. Next on the list is a Japanese film called Best Wishes to All, which is based on a short film by the same director. This came out in 2023. The director is Yuta Shimotsu. I can see how this concept might work better as a short film than a feature-length film, but at the same time, I loved the feature-length version, and I thought it was really well done, and the concept will just haunt me forever. It's about a young woman who visits her grandparents and then discovers that the family happiness comes from capturing another person and draining them of all of their happiness, and they've just kept this person as a prisoner in their house for this purpose. And then she realizes that that's how everybody does it, and that everybody's happiness is dependent upon draining somebody else who is an unwilling captive in other people's homes. And it just leads her on this journey of descent. It just leads her to question all of her choices, her reality, her sanity, and whether or not she is going to conform, whether or not she is going to go along with this. And how can she fight something that is so societally ingrained? And yeah, just the ending is so, oh, yeah, I just, yeah, this is one that's going to stick with me again, I think, for quite a long time. Nearly there now. The next one is All the Moons, 2020, directed by Igor Legarreta. This is a Basque film. It's set during the final days of the last Carlist War, where a little girl is rescued from an orphanage and is turned into a vampire. It's about her growing up as a vampire and learning how to walk in the sunlight again and just spending all of this time in the dark, not being able to physically age, but living for so long, and then how she tries to blend in again with society, the way that she can't really do that, and then the only way that she is able to kind of have her life back is for her sire to be destroyed. And so there's a bit of a sad kind of showdown, I guess, with the woman who turned her. It's not even a showdown, it's kind of more like getting that woman to realize that she did it for selfish reasons. And yeah, just so that she can be really, and you know, trying to persuade her to release her. And that all happens, I think, in the Spanish Civil War. It's a film that's bookended by war, and it felt to me almost like it's actually about the impact of war trauma on children. And maybe how trauma like that just can stunt your growth in various areas, that you're just always carrying it with you and carrying the impact with you throughout your life, and you have to find some way of being released from that. I don't know. I think there's lots of things going on in there. That's one of the things that I thought when I was watching it. So yeah, so All the Moons, I think, is definitely up there for me. It definitely reminds me a bit of the way that Guillermo del Toro treats children and childlike perspectives in his films. I was thinking about The Devil's Backbone specifically, and the way he uses orphan children perspectives. It also reminded me of the film The Orphanage a little bit, and kind of the ghosts of orphan children and the impact and the long-lasting impact that trauma and abuse can have on a child. Yeah, it just made me think of quite a lot of things. And so that one is definitely going to be up there for me. It's also beautifully shot. The cinematography in that one is gorgeous. And I think it's one of the better vampire films that I've seen. It has, again, like I suppose with the child vampire, kind of let the right one in vibes, but it also reminded me of You Will Not Be Alone, which is the Yorin Stilevski film, which is a sort of Macedonian Australian film. And that, in fact, is the very next one, number 9 on my list. Yorin Stilevski's You Won't Be Alone came out in 2022. It's set in an isolated mountain village in 19th century Macedonia, in which a girl basically gets turned into a witch and becomes immortal that way. But she accidentally kills a peasant girl and then assumes that girl's shape to see what life is like in her skin, and discovers that she's actually married to a really abusive man. And people think that her attitude changed, the way that she suddenly can't communicate and doesn't seem to understand basic things, is because she's just been beaten so badly that it's turned her mind. And so she starts learning from other people in the village. She starts learning about patriarchal society. She starts learning about men and women and their interactions. She starts learning about village culture. And then she changes her shape multiple times until she ends up in the skin of a little girl, and this time grows up as that little girl and sort of has a do-over in that way. But all the way through the film, the witch that turned her comes back constantly to remind her that nobody can love her except the witch, that only the witch can really have her. She can only fulfill her potential while she's with the witch, and the witch thinks that she's useless. And so you have all of these, like, really dark whispering voices, I suppose. And again, it's just one of those things that just worked for me in a lot of ways. So I think actually All the Moons and You Won't Be Alone make a very good double bill in terms of the way that they talk to each other and the different themes that they have, sort of converging and saying the same thing but in maybe different ways, and having similar themes but doing different things with them. So yeah, so I quite like those two. The final one is a British film called The Power that came out in 2021, directed by Corina Faith. This one is set in London in 1974 in a hospital where the rolling blackouts in the 70s are causing chaos. And it's also about fighting corruption within the hospital itself. Specifically, it's about sexual abuse and corruption, not just in the hospital structure and in the children's ward, and how the powerful people in that scenario, the doctors, are protected by other doctors, also protected by nurses who don't want to say anything, and how all the structures are set up to disbelieve women and girls and to neuter them and to minimize their testimonies and push them aside. But also, it's about how that happens through all levels of society, because Val, the main character, has had a similar experience before in a different context where it was her headmaster and she was told to tell everyone that she was lying and to retract her statements. So people now think that she's lying about that. They don't believe her when she discovers this other abuse that's happening under her nose in the hospital where she now works. And it's also about fighting that power imbalance and finding your own voice and finding your own means of empowerment. So, yeah, it's a ghost story, but it's also a multi-layered ghost story. I'll just be thinking about that one for quite some time as well. So that goes on the list, and that is my top 10 films from this year's 100 Horror Movies in 92 Days. And that's that for this mini-series. See you again soon. Happy Halloween. Bye for now.